What I want to talk about today is just a bit of personal history, how I came to know about Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger, and Berkshire Hathaway, and then just some concepts I've learned from them. It's not an exhaustive list. I'm sure Corky will fill in a lot of the gaps. He's been to many more of those meetings than I have. And then I'll finally end off with some quotes that, you know, found resonance with me over time. So going back to the beginning, I used to, when I was much, much younger, I used to play a lot of touch rugby. And there was one game at Hamilton Rugby Club in Cape Town where a lot of guys from financial services played. I, at that time, was working as a junior analyst at Allan Gray. And Allan Gray was going through a really tough time. The firm Allan Gray was going through a tough time. We lost more than half assets under management. And Allan flew down from London during bonus time, end of the year. And instead of dishing out bonuses, he fired more than half the company. Just, in those days, you could still do that. So we went from a business of 50 people down to less than 30 people. I was fortunate enough to keep my job, not because of any brilliance on my part, because I was so junior that my payroll, my salary made no difference to the payroll at all. So it wouldn't have mattered if he'd fired me. But it did open my eyes to the vicissitudes of the business of open-ended fund management. Another guy who played touch rugby at Hamilton's was a guy called Hendrik de Toey at the time. He had just started Investec and was tasked to build an asset management business at that time called Investec Asset Management. There were 10 to 12 people there. I think I was employee number 12 at that time. And he pitched this idea next to the touch rugby field after a game one day of this big asset management business that he wanted to build. And that vision found favor with me. So I resigned from Allan Gray and joined him. And this was probably about 1994, around about there. Needless to say, of course, Allan Gray went on to become a massive firm, one of the bigger third-party institutional fund managers in the country. But I joined this 12-person team, and over time it also grew a bit. We, you know, 5 years later when I left to start RECM, it had grown to 100 people with offices in Sydney, Hong Kong, London, Joburg, Cape Town. It also, you know, I left to start RECM 5 years later, and after I left, Investec Asset Management also went on to become, I think it is today, the largest third-party fund management firm in the country. Again, most of this happened after I left. So if there's one takeaway here, which has got nothing to do with Berkshire Hathaway, is if you want to start a successful asset management business, employ me and hope I leave soon. So I started then at Investec, this young company, and at Allan Gray, I was sort of managing fixed income, analyzing fixed income, managing bond portfolios with some financial bank stock analysis as well. When I joined Investec, Hendrik threw me in the deep end, institutional balanced fund portfolio management, reporting back to heavyweight boards of trustees, and I realized I had no idea at all of what I was doing. No clue. So when you're faced with this sort of situation in life, you can do one of two things. You can fake it till you make it, or you can try and learn and understand about what you're supposed to do, and you learn from people who can do it. So I started reading everything I could from the likes of Byron Vian, from who the guys, the famous guys of those time. All the guys who were writing books and managing money. You know, I read everything they wrote, everything I could get my hands on. And all of it started pointing towards one guy in Omaha called Warren Buffett and his investment holding company called Berkshire Hathaway. So this was something I had to learn more about as well. So I started reading all his shareholder letters at that time. Because I was analyzing banks, or I had an interest in analyzing banks, I annually attended an investment conference in New York run by UBS, a banking conference. It took place every year at the end of April. And I was going to this every year. And then I found out that Berkshire Hathaway happened to have their annual shareholders meeting on the first Saturday of May. So I thought, well, let me go check out this, what was termed at the time, the Woodstock of capitalism. So I wanted to go see what happened. And so I went off to this bank conference. I went to Omaha and attended this one. It was held in what is called the Aksar Ben Colosseum, which was like an old rodeo stadium. Didn't hold that many people. But what I saw there blew my mind completely. Here were two guys that were sitting on stage for 6 hours plus, answering unscripted questions from their shareholders. Now, you don't see this sort of thing. Or at that time, you never saw this sort of thing anywhere in the world. So in the middle of flyover to USA, they were sitting answering questions from shareholders. And they were saying stuff you would never hear from any sell-side analyst with which we had lots of interaction, any company executive, or any textbook. And it definitely was not what we as analysts and portfolio managers in South Africa were talking about or thinking about at all. And the amazing thing, it was all just plain common sense. Over the years, I've tried to assimilate a lot of what I learned from them, their message, and I can't say I've done so perfectly. But what I can say is my life has turned out so much better than it would have had I not come across Buffett, Munger, and Berkshire Hathaway and attended so many of their shareholders' meetings. So the Berkshire Hathaway way of thinking, this Woodstock of common sense, I like to call it, really benefited me in my life. And by process of osmosis, I've tried to absorb at least some of their learnings. And the great thing about these learnings were it wasn't a sermon from up on high by some high priest of finance. What they were talking about, as I said, were just bits and pieces of common sense woven together into anecdotes drawn from real life, both personal and financial and business, which made it tangible and understandable. More importantly, Buffett and Munger showed that if you applied these principles that they spoke about, these common sense principles that they spoke about consistently, you could be successful. 2 years ago, I took two of my sons, Nick and Ben, also I took them to Omaha, and this happened to be the last meeting at which both Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger were present. And I hope that some of what they saw and experienced there over time will rub off on them, onto the next generation. So that's my background. That's how I came to know about it, just through a process of wanting to learn about this job that I had no idea was what I was supposed to do. So the concepts that stuck with me over time that I'd like to share with you, and again, the corky will fall in here. The first one is the privilege of being able to work within a seamless web of deserved trust. When you see Charlie and Warren talk about this and interact with each other, that is what they implicitly trust each other and the people around them. And I was privileged enough in my life to find two business partners in which I have implicit trust and they have trust in me as well. Jan van Niekerk and Tennis de Bain. Tennis is here at this conference as well for the first time. And that has added tremendous value to my life, that web of deserved trust within which can operate with your business partners. The second thing, the second concept, which I found quite illuminating, very simple concept, and that is that stocks, shares, represent part ownership of actual businesses. They are not pieces of paper that are shuffled around in response to the ringing bells and sounding buzzers of that big casino called the stock market. They represent actual parts of businesses. And that's how one should think about them. The third concept is that of Mr. Market. Warren Buffett talks about his manic depressive business partner, Mr. Market, who most days is very even keeled and comes to the office, does his job and goes home again, and you don't need to pay him any attention at all. But some days he comes in there and he's completely depressed and he will offer his part of the business to you at a very low price. And other days he comes in and he's completely manic and he is prepared to pay any price to buy your part of the business. And Warren Buffett says, all you need to do is on those days, take advantage of your business partner. And the rest of the time, do nothing. And that concept stuck with me for a long time as well. The fourth concept, which they highlighted many times in their meetings, is the institutional imperative. Big businesses have their own way of doing things, And these are things that one should avoid as far as possible. The first aspect of the institutional imperative is that of Newton's first law. Institutions are governed by Newton's first law of motion, which says that any institution will resist change in its current direction. It will just carry on doing what it does forever. The second aspect of the institutional imperative is just as work expands to fill the allotted time, projects or acquisitions will materialize to soak up any company's excess funds, as if by magic. The third aspect of the institutional imperative is that any business craving of the leader will be, however foolish, will be immediately supported by detailed rates of return and strategic rationale and studies prepared by his underlings. That just happens all the time. Another thing that is to be avoided. The fourth aspect is that the behavior of your peer companies, whether it's expanding, acquiring, or setting executive compensation, will be mindlessly imitated. Those are the four aspects of institutional imperative that in running a business one should always bear in mind. The fifth concept which stuck with me is the concept of, I think Charlie Munger mentioned this many times, to a man with a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And the way you fight against this concept is you build a latticework of mental models drawn from different fields. Like, for instance, from engineering, you know, the concept of redundancy or the margin of safety, which you can build into financial analysis as well. From physics, entropy and the energy it takes to fight against entropy. From psychology, the power of incentives. One of the big threads throughout everything I've done is if you understand incentives, you understand what will happen. And there's many, many more of those. So I'll end off with some of the best quotes. And these quotes, I'm just going to read them all verbatim because they are so good, you know, I don't want to do them any injustice by misquoting them. So just some from Warren Buffett. So Buffett says, "I don't know to what extent it's innate or to what extent it's learned, but an ability to detach yourself from the crowd is a quality you need. The ability to detach yourself from the crowd is an ability you need. A great IQ is not needed. You do not have to be terrifically smart to do well as an investor." Now, I've always found great comfort in that saying, and it's true. The second one is, this is not like Olympic diving where they have a degree of difficulty factor where if you can do some very difficult dive, the payoff is greater than some easy dive. That's not true in investments. You get paid just as well for the simple dive as long as you execute it properly. The third quote is, Warren Buffett says, "We basically have the attitude that you can't make a good deal with a bad person. So we just forget about it. We don't try and protect ourselves with due diligences or contracts or getting into all sorts of negotiations. We just forget about it. We can do fine over time dealing with people we like, admire, and trust." And I think that's a very important concept to carry with you through your investing and business life. Fourth one, "We think it's awful, frankly, the way that businesses reward executives with absolutely no regard for the cost of capital." And finally, yeah, so that's more of an esoteric investment one, but that is true. Many of you that have worked in companies or analyzed companies will know that executive comp is a bugbear of many of us. And Charlie Munger, he's got some proper zingers. The first one from Charlie is, "Acquire worldly wisdom and adjust your behavior accordingly. If your new behavior gives you a little temporary unpopularity with your peer group, well, then to hell with them." The second one is, "I think I developed more courage after I learned I could handle hardship. So maybe you should get your feet wet with a little more failure." Remember, this comes from a guy who lost his son at the age of 9 to leukemia and nearly went blind at the age of 50. So he had a lot of hardship in his life, but it did give him, he took that hardship and it gave him courage to do things. The third thing he said that stuck with me is, if you think your IQ is 160 and it's actually only 150, you're a disaster. It's much better to be a guy with 130 IQ that's operating well within himself. Fourth one, we try and think like Fermat and Pascal as if we had never heard of modern finance theory. I really think that a lot of modern finance theory can only be described as disgusting. He also said, I think a great strategy for the great mass of humanity is to specialize. Nobody wants to go to a doctor who's half proctologist and half dentist. And finally, from Charlie, people have always had this craving to know the future. And this, I mean, when people speak to me about investing, they always want to know, what do you think is going to happen next week, next month, next year? And first of all, I don't know. Second of all, nobody knows. And third of all, it doesn't matter. And Charlie, in this quote, said it beautifully. People always have this craving to know the future. The king used to hire the magician or the forecaster, and he'd look at sheep guts or something for an answer as to how to handle the next war. There's always been a market for people who purport to know the future based on their expertise, and there's a lot of that still going on. People have an economic incentive to sell some nostrum. It can be sold over and over again. I think it's disgusting. It's much better to make a living by being part of a system that delivers value to the people who are buying the product. And then one of the best interactions, I happened to be at the shareholders meeting where this little interaction took place. It was Warren and Charlie sitting on the stage, and Charlie had just given this long analysis of some company, how to value it and how to think about it. And he ended off with saying that, so I think reduced expectations are the best defense any investor has. And Warren said, yeah, Charlie's quite big on lowering expectations. And Charlie came back at him and said, yeah, absolutely, I agree. That's the way I got married. My wife lowered her expectations. And then Warren ended off the little interaction by saying, yeah, and he lived up to them. So I'll end off with another, my favorite Charlie Munger quote of all time. And it's mostly used after Warren had given some long explanation to a shareholder question, gone into a lot of detail and said a lot of things. And then asked Charlie if he'd like to say anything. And Charlie would say, I have nothing further to add. Thank you.
So I didn't want to go to Omaha in between the Groot Groene at Old Mutual and Sanlam. I spent 5 years at Coronation. And when I arrived there, Walter Aylett came to me and he said, you know, he wants to go to Omaha and listen to Warren and Charlie, and he says Pete is going, and Pete has been before, so he's done all the hard work. We can just tag along with Pete. And yes, I went and I looked on the map and I saw Omaha is there in the middle of Nebraska, in the middle of the US. I say, is it like going to Bloemfontein? Why go to Bloemfontein? You know, there he goes. Fortunately, Walter convinced me to go, and that was 99. And Pete will remember those were the tech years where. The tech bubble, where investors were standing up. And because Warren and Charlie had always said they will not invest in anything where they can't see the end game and they can't determine the value, and they had not invested in any tech shares. And investors were standing up and asking, Mr. Buffett, Mr. Munger, please, please just buy even 5% of your cash, use it to buy tech shares. And there were all kinds of names. And Warren is normally the nice guy. Charlie is just the guy who says, if you believe that, you shouldn't be in the same room with us. But okay. And then obviously the next year, the tech bubble had burst. And then investors were standing up and saying, Mr. Buffett, Mr. Munger, we thank you so much for not having been invested in tech shares. But we might be experiencing the same again. But after that first meeting, we went to Omaha and we met those days. You could still meet Warren and Charlie afterwards. Foreign investors could get their signature and chat to them. And we actually met them a few times, also with Bill Gates. And I must just add, Alec arranged one evening for us to have a dinner with Howard Buffett, Warren's son, who is now the chairman of Berkshire Hathaway, and that was actually Saul, one of my memories. But after that first time, I realized this is special. Exactly as Pete said, these guys are so rational and so how they think about business. I said, we've got to start taking South African CEOs and CFOs to Berkshire Hathaway. And when we started that process, we took Larry Diponor, we took Yanni Maton, we took Ian Kirk, we took a lot of guys, and gradually more and more people came. Bernard Swanepoel and Willem Roos. And Larry Diponor, when he went the first time, was the same as me. He was so blown away by how these guys think. He actually went and appointed Alagog to do a program for the First Rand Group and take it around the whole First Rand Group to educate them about the Berkshire Hathaway culture. Remember those days? You could actually stand here and do this talk. So Alec went quite a few years. Thereafter, he got himself a press accreditation. He didn't sit with us plebs in the big hall. He sat upstairs. David Shapiro used to come along. But the main thing is we kept going and taking investors along, exactly as Pete said, because of the way they think. Now, maybe just to take you on the journey for 5 minutes, 3 minutes, Warren Buffett gained control of Berkshire Hathaway in 1965. Berkshire Hathaway was actually two textile mills, Berkshire and Hathaway, and they merged in 1955, I think, and the only people who made money out of that merger were the investment bankers, because shareholders just kept on losing and the share prices kept on going down. Why? Because even in 1955, American textile mills couldn't compete with Chinese textile mills. The imports from China were too cheap because the cost of labor in China was so much cheaper than. So maybe Trump should have been around in 1955 and raised tariffs. But whether that will work is another question. But the main thing is, and as Warren said, he didn't realize that because he just looked at the valuation of the business and it was so cheap that he kept buying. And it's another story as to how he gained control. But one day he woke up and he had bought too many shares and he had a controlling share. And Charlie, who had met in 1959, phoned him immediately and said, Warren, this is one of the dumbest things you've done in your life. Yeah. He was very critical of buying Berkshire Hathaway first place and then secondly getting control. But he said, now that you've got control, use this opportunity to sell the textile assets and fill this business with buying good companies, cash-generating businesses, and that will generate cash and allow you to buy other businesses. And Warren, by that stage, learned to respect Charlie's intellect, and so he did that with Charlie, who became his vice chairman. And over the next 60 years, they built this failing textile mill into, I think it's the seventh largest organization in the U.S., employing 383,000 people, 189 subsidiaries. The compound return of, had you bought Berkshire Hathaway in 1965, well, he actually works the compound return on the net asset value per growth, net asset value per share growth, but the share price keeps track generally with it, has been over 60 years, wait for it, 20%, okay, it's 19.8 or something, 20% per annum for 60 years. The S&P, by the way, has done 10. Now, guys like Pete and myself, we've got teams and we work our backsides off to try and outperform the market by 1% or 2%. These guys have done it by 10% for 60 years. So someone asked Warren, but everybody knows how you do it and everybody knows it's been successful. Why do so few copy it? And his answer was, very few people like to get rich slowly. most want to make a return of 50% and 50%, you know, rather than a 20-20 or even a 15-15. So what made them special? Peter has referred to quite a few points. I think the most important, Peter also said, is this is the simplicity, the way they think rationally, but simple lifestyles, keeping stress low and keeping time free. So both of them, by the way, Warren lived in and still lives in Omaha all his life, and he's still got the same house. I think it's now 50 years already, same house. Charlie moved to Los Angeles and lived in the same house for also something like 40 years. Used to drive the same car for 20 years. And 1 year, shareholder stood up at the meeting, said, "Mr. Buffett, be very concerned about your car. It hasn't even got airbags. As shareholders, we'd really like you to buy a new car. So it's safer for all of us." And he said, "Look, the problem with a new car is so much time I've then got to invest in understanding this car and then reading the manual. Yeah, I can use that time to read an annual report of a good company." But they basically kept their lives simple. And as Pete said, the most important thing was to stay on ethics. Do a contract on one page. He said, if you need more than one page for a contract, you don't want to do business with those people. But then understanding investment odds, really understanding what the quality of a business and its future cash flows are and how much to pay for it. But what a lot of investors forget always when they make an investment is to judge the risks, the risk of losing. In other words, am I, the price I'm paying, is there enough margin of safety in that price? And that's really what made them special. And so in doing that, they always focused on companies that they have a higher degree of certainty about their future growth, about the ability to keep reinvesting the cash flow into further growth. And South Africa, with quite a few of those very successful businesses, I mean, ShopRite has been one under Whitey Basson, Pep under Christo Visa, who just kept on growing, reinvesting the capital. On the banking side, you've had Capitec, unbelievable example of just reinvesting the capital and growing further. Recently in South Africa on the insurance side, OUTsurance, unbelievable business. But it's a real ability to keep investing that cash flow. Now, obviously a problem whenever we see Gerry Fourie, always the main question they ask is, okay, you know, how do you ensure that you can continue that growth? Because the biggest risk to any business is bureaucracy, that the Capitec becomes too big and that agility and that ability to make decisions starts being dissipated away. But the main thing is quality of business, but then the price you pay. You know, the valuation is always key. So in that regard, it's famous for saying you must buy when everybody is fearful and sell when everybody is greedy. And, you know, you keep that in mind, as Pete says, when the guys are manic, then you sell. When they're depressed, then you buy. And that's actually such a simple principle, but it's so difficult for an investor to do because our horizon often isn't long enough and our patience isn't good enough. And then two things they never worry about is what the markets are doing and what the economy is doing. Well, that's not entirely true. They are very aware of the present and obviously understand the past, but they don't spend time trying to worry about where the market or the economy is going. Warren is famous for saying 10 minutes spent on analyzing future economic indicators is 10 minutes wasted. And if I just remind you of the last 5 years, 2019, great year, markets were strong, we were all positive, bullish. And then in January, February, you start hearing about this new bug. And by March, economies are closed down. Now, if you built your strategy in 2019 on this everlasting growth, now suddenly 2019, but okay, you can say that was unforeseen. I didn't So what did the central banks do? They started pumping liquidity into the economies, and suddenly, surprise, surprise, we start getting inflation. What does the Fed say? Fed most probably has the largest team of analysts, data scientists, economists in the world. The Fed, on the common wisdom of all those people, say inflation is transitory. We are not going to hike interest rates. So you doing all your work and trying to, and what interest rates, okay, interest rates at least are not going to go up. I can buy this or I can buy that. What happens the next 2 years? Interest rates are hiked to 5%. Why? Because inflation. I'm just trying to, don't spend too much time worrying about, you know, what will happen to interest rates. Focus the time, and that's what these guys did on understanding the companies. A good management team will do the same work, will understand what's happening, and reshape, react their business far quicker and more effective. So rather spend your time making sure you're with your good management team. A classical example at the moment is the difference between Liverpool and Manchester United. Sorry, I am a Manchester United fan. There's a cry club over there just now. We can go and cry. And I just watch the games to just take notes the whole time about what are these guys doing wrong. And now remember, Manchester United, they've had almost as many coaches as they had CEOs. But it's that board that sits there and appoints these coaches. And each guy doesn't meet the requirements, get fired, huge cost, another guy. The next guy comes in, he inherits this team of players who don't play his style. I mean, sorry, I don't have to go on, but it is so important that you get the right management team. So all our focus, Pete's focus, what Warren and Charlie, make sure that you've got the right management team in place. They will do the work for you. I thought there's one thing that struck me again today of when I read some of the old shareholder letters. By the way, I would recommend go and read this year's shareholder letter. You just go Berkshire Hathaway on the web and shareholders letters. You can read this one. Hopefully, once you've read this one, you'll enjoy it and go and read the previous five ones. It's actually very illuminating as to how they think about the business, about their staff, about. But it's interesting when they had their part, when Charlie Warren had his partnership. He went to his neighbors and he said, I'd like to manage your money. And they said, any case, some of them and his sisters. And so he said, okay, we'll give you some money. By the way, the neighbors that obviously didn't join in that partnership are very sorry. But the points he made, this is in the 1950s, a young Warren Buffett, 33 years old, are still exactly the same today. He said to his investors, his partners, firstly, I'll speak to you only once a year. I'm not going to communicate with you every month how the fund is doing. Secondly, I don't promise short-term returns. You must measure me over three-year periods. Thirdly, investments will be chosen because of their value, not because of popularity. That's very actually interesting. Fourthly, we will try and keep your capital losses to a minimum by always making sure we have a good margin for error. So in other words, we have a discounted price. We only invest in stocks that are trading at a discount to what their value is. And we'll also try and be diversified. Okay. I'm going to end off with that diversification just quickly and tell you three stories if there's time. I showed four fingers because there's actually four stories. I'm hoping I'm getting to the fourth. Okay, very quickly. A fascinating story was in the 1960s, I'll just get my notes right again. It doesn't really matter. It was American Express had lent money to a guy, Antonio De Angelis, also known as Jimmy the Salad Oil King. He was a mafioso he'd been involved in other scandals. But okay, let's go and Google it. It's actually a very interesting story. Jimmy imported salad oil from Italy into big containers and then distributed into the U.S., and American Express actually financed it. And one day, a story is actually quite interesting, but okay, one day, American Express want to call in their debt and they can't find Jimmy and there's no money. And they say, okay, we'll go what they call in legal terms. We'll go and perfect our security. We'll get the sheriff to go out to the containers and put stamps on. They now belong to American Express. Finally, guys go and open the containers. And what do they find? The containers are filled with seawater. There's just an inch of salad oil at the top. And as you know, salad oil. So the audit clerks would always go put in their dipstick and it was full. And then they check that it's oil. But when the bank wanted to go and get the asset to recoup the debt, it was nothing. So the American Express price starts falling. Yes, and it collapses. But the American Express, the card business was then already a very big, important business for American Express. And Warren had always looked at American Express, was very interested and impressed with the way they managed their business. So he did the calculation of what he thought the card business was worth based on the number of cards in issue, which is published, and number of the average spend, et cetera, et cetera. And the share price fell below the value of the card business, and quite far below. And so what Warren did, just to verify, he actually spent a few evenings going to Gorat's, his favorite restaurant, and just sitting opposite the desk where people would pay. And so the lady, I just want to make sure that there's no brand damage to American Express, that people are still using their cards to pay. And when he saw people were still using the American Express cards to pay, he started buying American Express as the share price went down, until it was 38% of his portfolio. Wow, that's quite a concentrated bet. But he'd obviously done his homework, and as the price went down further, it was one of his best investments. The other one was 1987, when Coke fell dramatically. Remember the big market correction in 87? And he bought, in the next 12 months, he bought up to 7% of Coke shareholding, and it went up 10 times in the next 10 years. So, there's one other, I've got time for two, both, okay. There's one other great story about his ability to, when he buys businesses, he delegates. He delegates authority. Now, in 1969, they had bought a 12% stake in Salomon Brothers, which is now Bank of America. It was a bit later. Doesn't matter. The story is more important. There was a scandal. It's also an interesting one. You can go and Google it, where a guy inside Treasury was gaming the system, and the Fed found out about it. They warned management. Management didn't react. Warren Buffett at that stage was on the board because they had such a large shareholding, and the Fed was so incensed with the reaction and what had happened. They decided, on the Friday afternoon, they're going to close Salomon down. It's a bit like Lehman Brothers. Get the phone call, Lehman Brothers is gone. Just imagine one morning you wake up here, one of our large banks, I mustn't mention a name now, this week, cause of a bank run here, is a large South African bank. On Monday morning, it's closed. Offices are closed. You can't get deposits. You can't. And obviously that would have meant a big lack of confidence in the system. And so the board suggested to the Fed that they get Warren Buffett to take over as chairman, executive chairman, just to restore confidence. They thought there's one guy in America that people will trust. It's Warren Buffett. And so this whole weekend it went to and fro with Warren Buffett, you know, and he had his requirements as to how he would do it. The bottom line of the story is that the decision had to be communicated to the press but before 6 o'clock in the evening on Sunday, because that's when the Japanese markets open. And if it hadn't been resolved, the Japanese would start selling American bonds. And so at, I think it was 5:15, the Fed said to Warren, okay, you've got to go ahead on the criteria that Warren said on which he would do it. And so the press was already there. His blood. Oh, there's this press reporters, and Warren gets to the front and he starts talking to them. And he says, and I think his name was Dick, doesn't matter. Tony is going to be the CEO. And it's the first Tony hears of it. He's going to be the CEO. So it's over, the press run to write the story. Warren says, can you call a cab? I want to take a flight to back to Omaha. And Tony says, but Warren, you can't go now. I first want to have dinner with you. How am I going to, you know, run the ship? What do you want me to do? He said, Tony, I decided on you because I think you're the right guy for the job. If you need me to have dinner with you, then I've made a mistake. And he said, cheers, and he got his taxi, and he went off to Omaha, and Tony from there on was running the business. Ek gaan een heel laaste story vertel, baie vinnig. Catherine Graham, go and read the story on Catherine Graham and the famous dinner where Warren Buffett went, and he, it was an 8-course dinner, but he liked hamburgers and chips. And so in the end, they got the chef to do 8 different versions of hamburger and chips for him, because he said, that's what I want.
Yeah, you can't get these guys talking about the Obasa because they will never end. But that bookstore over there comes from Omaha. At the Berkshire Hathaway AGM, they have a little bookstore called The Bookworm, and you get books there that you can't really get anywhere else in the world because every book that's in there is endorsed by Buffett or Munger. And that is where you realize that these guys were obsessed about reading. We used to have a press conference that I went to every Sunday afternoon. It was amazing, just 30 people. When you tried to ask of the 40,000 people, you try and ask a question during the AGM, you had to stand, you had to get up at 4 in the morning, stand in a long queue, hope you get to a microphone. But of course, being a member of the press, it was like 30 of you, you each got to ask a question. And I asked him about how much he reads, and he was then about 85. He said, no, you know, I've slowed down a lot. I only read one book a day now. It used to be 2 or 3. And he said, when I get tired, when I've read and I get tired, I need to just keep reading because that is the difference in my life. And it's an interesting thing. Elon Musk, if you go and read Elon Musk's, both of the biographies, the one with Isaacson and the other one with Ashley Vance, he said that when he was a little boy, they didn't have too many books in the house, but they did have an encyclopedia, and he read it twice after he'd finished all the books in the library. So that comes, that bookstore over there, I haven't endorsed all of the books by any means, but they've done a good job in bringing some very interesting books there. It's part of this conference. Go and have a look at the books. There's a heck of a lot that you can learn from it. And a final point on that was Laurie Dippenaar, who said to me before I could go for the first meeting, he never sponsored us, by the way. That was Standard Bank, Shift. That was the late Brett Duncan, who said, you go over there and you go and learn about Berkshire and come back and tell our clients. And many of you, I hope, saw those roadshows that we did. But Laurie said to me, if you want to come with me and Corky, you have got to read a book by Roger Lowenstein called The Making of an American Capitalist, a thick book like this. And that was how staunch he was. The other reason for taking me along was I'm not a very good golfer, and he's not very good either, but he took me to go and play golf with him so he wasn't as bad as, anyway, you know the story. Okay, so we've got a few minutes for questions and a lot of questions. So guys, let's keep them a bit short if we can. Sure. Karat Lumpen asks, Berkshire Hathaway has far too much cash. Would you invest in them in this bull market? Cash is only good if you buy at the bottom.
Well, he's basically been saying the market's too expensive and he can't find good bargains. So he's sitting on the cash and the market is falling. And so hopefully he'll start, well, if the market falls enough, he'll start. With that track record, I would bet that he will make good purchases, or Ted and Todd now. And if you think 10 years, yeah, even if he does 15% per annum now, I think that's a good enough batting average.
Yeah, it's incredible. 20% per annum over 60 years is just, it's unheard of. So I guess Gerard, he kind of knows what he's talking about, even though he's in his, yeah. Charles asks for Pitt and Corky, what are the 2 or 3 books that have influenced your way of thinking the most, Pitt?
Yeah, I think probably the most important book for me personally that I've read, and I reread it almost every year, is The Lessons of History by Will and Ariel Durant. I think it's 100 pages, and it's the best read you can have. And
say it again.
The Lessons of History by Will and Ariel Durant. Fantastic book. I think Lowenstein's book on Buffett, Making America Capitalist, I think is fantastic. Probably if you want to learn about Buffett specifically, the best book is Snowball, his biography. That's probably, if you want to read about him. And the third book I would say is probably something along the lines of Lessons from a Stock Market Operator from the early 20th century.
That was about Jesse Livermore, was it?
Jesse Livermore, that's right, yeah.
Okay. If I were to, the Lowenstein book is still very good, Making of American Capitalist. I've been reading again Howard Marks, The Most Important Thing. Yes, it's actually fantastic. It's about risk, understanding risk. It's great. And then very interesting book is Range by David Epstein. It's not very well known, but it's a great book. It's about specialization versus generalization. And it's actually a fascinating book in terms of all the themes he takes you through, and very readable. It's Range.
Just say the name of it again.
Range.
R-A-N-G-E. Oh, R-A-N-G-E, Range.
Yeah, it starts with Tiger Woods and you know, how he was forced to be a specialist and, you know, develops that theme, David Epstein. It's actually very, very interesting. You'll enjoy it.
You know what I love about you guys? You've been doing this for many years, but you're still learning and you still go back to the really good books and continue to read them. Howard Marks, when did he write that Most Important Thing? It must be years ago.
10 years or something.
It's fairly recent, updated again, but let's say 5-10 years. Oh, so, yeah.
Okay.
From good to great. I see
Twitter. Now you're getting heckled. Don't worry. It comes with the territory. How would Pete and Corky approach asset allocation in China? This is from Derek Martin. What are their views on major tech stocks like Alibaba and Tencent? Technology value plays like Baidu and Pinduoduo, SOEs and so on. BYD is also in.
I can talk about stocks specifically, but don't listen to what I say about them because I'm probably going to be wrong. And I can take a step back, and I do have a long-term view that China is the future. America is the past. I think in terms of your asset allocation, I would, whatever you would allocate towards China on a neutral basis, I would have a bit more than that. And whatever you would regard the American weight as being neutral, I would probably have a bit less than that. And each person will have their own preferred asset allocation on the basis of that. But I would shade my asset allocation in that direction based on my view of the next 50 years of where China is going and where the West is going.
Would you, just to elaborate there, would you still avoid process? Would you go direct to Tencent?
No, I think there's a case to be made to buy Naspers or Prosus. There is the capital allocation risk of them misallocating capital away from Tencent, which is a fantastic business, into less good businesses. So there is that risk. But I think at the current discount, NAV, you're probably being paid for that. So, but you can argue that both ways. I mean, I don't want to get into the nuts and bolts of that argument. I think there's a case to be made to own Naspers or Prosus. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, firstly, you just got to think, is China going to invade Taiwan? Because if it does, then China stocks won't be investable for a while. But that's a fat tail risk now.
Yeah.
I mean, but I agree with Pete. We used to look at the Chinese banks. I used to go there every year for 3 or 4 years. You can't trust the management. You can't trust the numbers in terms of the NPL.
Can you trust American management?
Huh?
Can you trust American management?
No, true. some of them. But okay. But so I would rather, as Pete says, like your Alibaba's, even we've been looking at Ping An, with Discovery as a JV with, those type of businesses that are more visible, but also that export to outside, and then rather go for a Hong Kong listing than a Chinese listing. But we've had very, very poor experiences with the Chinese regulators when things went wrong.
At its peak, Apple made up 50% of Berkshire Hathaway's portfolio. Is that correct?
I think.
How did he explain that to his investors?
Well, I don't think he needs to explain very much. He made a fantastic investment decision to buy Apple when it was trading in single-digit P, and it did so well that it became 50. He didn't buy 50% of his assets into Apple. He bought a small percentage of assets, and Apple did so well that it became 50%. So, I mean, that's to be congratulated. I don't think that's something that needs to be explained. And he's also done well on the exit out of Apple. So, you know, I think he entered Apple when he was at the age of roughly 85, and he's exiting at the age of 95, roughly. I'm not sure exactly what his age is, but, you know, there's still, you know, for all of us in this room, there's still time to go. We can still make some good decisions.
James's question is going to have to be the last one, I'm afraid. He refers to Warren Buffett putting his money for his, well, doesn't quite, but to his wife, to Astrid, to put everything into the S&P 500. What do you make of that?
So there's always been a difference between Charlie and Warren. Charlie always, his advice was for the average person hasn't got the understanding to pick a good stock picker. So I'll just go with the index. It's cheap and it's, yeah. And so that's where that comes from. Charlie always differed vehemently. He told his children, put your money in Berkshire Hathaway shares.
Yeah, look, I think indexation makes a lot of sense. Whether you want to have exposure to the S&P 500, currently it's open debate. But indexation makes sense. Having said that, I think Berkshire Hathaway is almost an index of American business. So whether you're buying Berkshire Hathaway or S&P 500 over the next 10 to 20 years, I don't think there's going to be much difference between the two, personally.
Pitt, Corky, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Alex.